Good morning, everybody. Okay, so thank you for making your efforts to being here on time. We have a very good program this morning that I'd like to introduce. First, just in terms of context, when we plan these events, we sort of look at the hot items, and last night was sort of a schmorg. It was more of a what you would call sort of they call the entree. This morning we're going to get into some of the more detailed discussions. And if last night we introduced the theme of Lahadgil Torah Lahadira, I'd like to extend today that this morning that the discussion will be framed around the notion of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chayim. As you know, we're going to be discussing the topic of Matzitza v'Peh, which if you've been reading anything in the newspapers, anything in the internet in the past year, and you're on any of the links or anything, this has been a very controversial topic. Controversy is not something that is necessarily a negative thing in Yiddishkeit. And in Judaism, I think we celebrate that. In fact, I mean, there isn't a page in Shas, practically, with the exception of one parak that I am familiar with, that doesn't have a machlokas. The one that doesn't have a machlokas, as you may know, is we say it's an ezo makomen, and we say it in davening in the morning, and we say it and that's the only, unless the rabbanim here can tell me otherwise, I believe that that's the only place in Shas where there is no machlokas. So machlokas is very much a part of our culture. Having said that, when you look at the machlokas that we have between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, and they profess and they paskin shilas of to the point where a child could be a mamzer, the Gemara tells us that they married into each other's families. So the idea of machlokas and respect for opinions is extremely important. In order for this morning to go as planned, I will ask that our speakers present their topics. We've spoken to the speakers in advance. The idea is to bring forth some concepts and ideas. We will not take any questions during the presentation. Each will present for the allotted amount of time. There will then be a panel discussion in which the speakers and Rabbi Steinberg will be here to take questions. The questions will be done in such a way where you will prepare them in a written format. You will write your questions throughout this morning's session, and you will present them up, and we will collect them, and we will ask that the questions there. And in that way, we hope we can at the same time not only just hear the ideas, but we'd also be able to stimulate some discussion around these type of questions. So without further ado, and by the way, talk about planning. If you see up ahead, up on the screen now, we already have next year's reservations planned. So you can put it into your calendar, July 4th weekend of next year at Lake Placid. Mir Tashem, more information to come on that, but we will be working on that as well. Our first speaker this morning, let me just bring up the appropriate slides. Our first speaker this morning is Rabbi Dr. Benny Gesundheit. I'm very happy to say that I have known Rabbi Dr. Benny, but from the days of Benny, many years ago, and it's a pleasure to welcome him back to our conference. He has been here with us in the past. He is an amazing speaker. He has gone to yeshiva. He's at yeshiva Haritzion for 5 years. He has smicha from the Rei Rabbanut. He has also come to Toronto to do a PhD in medical ethics. He's a board-certified pediatrician, and he now has focused his attention on teaching Jewish medical ethics to the next generation. A fantastic speaker, a published writer, and a master of PowerPoint. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Rabbi Dr. Gesundheit.
Good morning. It's a great pleasure to be here. I would like to start with the Shevach Lachsania and the brilliance of organization by Rabbi Kelman And Dr. Friedman has many aspects which I'm not sure everybody knows, but I would like to show you a few aspects. The organization is perfect. On such a hot topic like Mitzitza Bepeh, Dr. Friedman, which means in Hebrew, Ish Shalom, it means you want to do it in a very peaceful way. That's the proper translation. Can you see that? Ish Shalom. I think that's the most important message that we want to achieve Shlemut Shalom Bais. I don't know.
Okay,
I think it's a question of the...
Okay.
We'll see. That's fine. We are in a place which is called the Heritage Hotel. It means we have to think about our masoret, our background. And the most interesting part, which I just found out recently, no doubt that Rav Kelman and Dr. Friedman had that in mind, we actually found out that Dr. Berman's father-in-law and myself are second cousins. So if the message is that we are all one family and all the discussions are L'shem Shamayim, there was no better way to accomplish that than to have this set up together. I would like to start with the bottom line of the pediatrics paper, which says that we support ritual circumcision, but without oral metzitza, which might endanger the newborns and is not part of the religious procedure. I came right to the bottom line to make the point clear. I fully support, of course, metzitza and want to do everything possible that the metzitza should be done. Kedat v'chavin, no danger and no embarrassment for anybody with that. So that might be the last name of the, which is on this initial slide. The message is not only my email, I think it's the name that everybody should be gesund and be healthy with that. Also Shulam Weiss in every sense. I would like to tell you the story before I come to the paper which is published in pediatrics. It started when I was in the pediatric emergency room 17, 18 years ago, and I saw at night a baby who was a floppy baby. Day 31, he had Brit Milah, came in with fever. He was absolutely inactive, didn't wake up for breastfeeding. And I asked all the questions, pediatric classical work, septic workup for a neonate with fever. It included the lumbar puncture, it included all the tests, and intravenous antibiotic treatment. Since I was aware of the topic of metzitza, I asked, How long ago was it that he had the mitzitza done, that he had the Brit Milah? It's 5 days ago. And I asked right away, how was the mitzitza done? And they didn't remember, they called, and they found out it was done mitzitza bepeh. For that, I started right away antiviral treatment. The next day, and we did also the so-called Zank test, which showed typical findings of viruses. It's not specific for herpes simplex. And we started the classical antibiotic treatment, acyclovir. The baby had fever for several days, and there were repeated lumbar punctures, and the MRI was done. He was admitted for 17 days with virus herpes simplex type 1 was found, which is associated to oral contact. He was treated for a long time, including preventive treatment afterwards. No need to explain how angry the family was about that, because they have not been aware of this issue at all. These are the typical lesions which are just next to the place of the mitzitza, as you can see here, some 6-7 days after mitzitza. Exactly on the place of the wound. The background on herpes simplex virus is that there is a type 1, a type 2. Both viruses can cause severe diseases. They are found in the herpes simplex from the mouth. Herpes simplex 1 is found from the mouth. Herpes simplex type 2 is found from the genital tract, and both can cause very severe diseases, mostly not significant, as you can see here. Since there is a good immune system, the neonate doesn't have a good mature immune system. The incubation period is between 1 to 26 days, mostly a week plus minus. The disease is severe enough that, according to a lot of authors, it should not cesarean section should be performed in order to prevent neonatal exposure in the birth canal from the mother's vagina. So it is a severe condition for the baby, justifying surgical delivery, a C-section. It's critical for me to present the halachic background because I want to support it and I want to understand it and I want to follow exactly what we learned from the Mishnah and the Talmud. Therefore, I have to present here briefly the background. The Mishnah says, Osim kol tzorkei milah b'shabbat mo'alim u'porim u'motzatzim v'notnim aleha is planit v'chamon. You do everything on Shabbat, regardless that there is a chilul Shabbat, because it is a mitzvah on the eighth day and it is pikuach nefesh on the eighth day. It means you do the milah, that means to cut the foreskin. Here are the five parts. The foreskin is here, you cut, that is the orla is removed. Once the orla is removed, po'im, it is brought down, that's the way it looks like. Atara is removed and that is exposed at the upper part, it's bleeding. And these two stages are considered part of the milah. Mal velo para et hamilah ke'ilu lo mal. If somebody does only first part without the second one, it's not considered milah. Afterwards, you do mitzitzah. One should do mitzitzah. It doesn't say a word about how to do it, with an instrument, with a mouth. It doesn't say a word. The blood is removed, and once the blood is removed, there is a ispelanit. All is done for the wound care of the newly circumcised baby. Is this part, mitzitzah, a medical procedure? Or is it the mitzvah? The Gemara is totally clear about it. There is not one question in the text of the Gemara. V'dumia de'is planit v'chamon. The same way you put the patch on it, gaz, the same way you put a certain powder from herbs, kamon, ma is planit v'chamon ilo avit sakanahu, af hachiname ilo avit sakanahu. If it's not done the mitzitzah, it is a danger for the baby. Therefore, you have to do it for medical issues specifically. And the Gemara says more than that. Rav Papa, Hai umna de lo ma'itz sakanahi ve'avrinam li. A mohel who is not performing the mitzitzah is endangering the baby. Therefore, he has to be fired. He is very strict about it. Pshita midekal chalchal alei shabbat sakanahi. And therefore, it has to be done for sakana. I'm not aware of any source who explains that mitzitzah is part of the mitzvat milah in the Gemara. Not one source. That is very clear, and I don't think there's any question about it in the pshat of the Gemara. However, there were a lot of controversies, as which you see clearly. But from this slide and background, we learn mitzitzah has one purpose to prevent an exposure to any danger. Only sakana. So what all these three actions, mitzitzah, the kamon, the ispelanit, has to prevent the danger. Nobody knows what today ispelanit and kamon exactly are, and if somebody would find in Roman excavations 5 million of pieces of ispelanit, no person would say we have to use this ispelanit to protect the baby after mitzitzah, because whatever is done to prevent the danger should be used. There is no special din of isplanit for kamon. You do it the way the danger is treated in the best way. So that's the baby. And I thought it is important to prevent for other babies that shouldn't happen anymore. The starting point for the study was very, very difficult. If you plan a study and you have a study design and a control group, you can work in a very clean, systematic way. Far away from getting there. Not only that there was a lack of compliance, there was actually a strong resistance, denial. And people got very upset, very nervous, very sensitive topic. And the resistance was not only from the Mohel, it was from rabbis, from the chief rabbinate of Israel. I was totally unsuccessful to get the pieces of information which are critical. And they refused to test for herpes. I learned about more cases. It's true that there is no data collection on that. The retrospective epidemiological study is very difficult. The charts are not reported properly. Nobody asks the question if it is 7 days or 20 days after Mila, after Mitzitza Bepe. Nobody asks the question if it was a Mitzitza Bepe or not. So therefore, it is very difficult to make clear statements on a retrospective. However, in order to prevent the situation, I decided to go for a study. And from different people, actually, those hospitals I worked at time in Israel, in Jerusalem, in Beersheba, and in Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, where I trained afterwards, I learned from many cases which just I happened to hear about them, and good experts told me about that. DNA fingerprints, I couldn't get them from the Mohalim in Israel because they refused to do it. And from other places where it was a retrospective study, it was, of course, not relevant to get it, which is too bad, but for I know that other people try to do it to get this information. From the 8 cases I could find, as I show here, it shows an association between the timing, the location of the disease, the specific lesions of Mitzitza Bepe, herpes simplex type 1, which is not found from the birth canal, it's not from the delivery. So these are clear indications why I think there is an association. And as I state here, it is most probably a consequence of the transmission by the Mohel's saliva. Still, as I heard from, as I explained, they were collected from personal communication. That is not a systematic, statistical, epidemiological study, which is not possible. I couldn't do it. There is no report. I work in oncology. We have very clear registry on each treatment, on each protocol which was used. No data available. I wanted to get them, absolute resistance to get them. And I will not share that in the talk here. But the ways people were not only in a lack of collaboration, there was very aggressive behavior from some people who said, Chilul Hashem, what are you doing, and blaming, and that is Reform Judaism, what are you doing? I won't go in these details here because I think that is very important as an underlying background, but I want to focus on the medical aspects. I was privileged to work with experts like Dan Engelhardt, head of infectious disease in Hadassah, Ron Dagan, head of infectious disease in Beersheba, Dr. Martin Petrit, head of virology in the Hospital for Sick Children, they have, and Dr. Greenberg, head of infectious disease later on in Beersheba. And we summarized these 7 children, and we found, from a lack of information in some of them, we found that there were 2 Mohalim who had been involved in the same. You see here the 2 Mohalim, blue. Same 2 Mohalim. It's true that it was not the day afterwards. So we could find a certain group collected were 8 patients who needed a lot of workup, a lot of days of admission, including LP and disease for several days. I didn't include every child I heard about which had no workup done at all, where had no access, but meanwhile I heard about more cases. The question is in place why there is such a low incidence of reported cases, only 8 babies at a period of 6 years. And it's impressive. The reasons are simple. A bleeding wound is a poor port of entry. The direction goes the other way, so very little infections come in while actively bleeding. Secondly, if there is no active new infection, the probability that that the infection will be transmitted to the baby is not very high. If there is a mouthwash done with wine, alcohol beforehand, it might be very clean, even there would be an infection at the first time. And last but not least, there is an underreporting and a refusal. So if I have only 8 cases, which is for me absolutely enough to make a clear conclusion, if we have only 8 cases, it doesn't mean that there aren't much more available. And to show the main message was to show that prompt treatment for neonatal sepsis should include antibiotics, as done usually, plus, if oral mitzitza was performed, antiviral treatment as well. I heard many cases that they did it, from Mohalim, from pediatricians, and they really found viruses in the blood, sometimes even the lesions. And that is the main message as shown in the paper. the discussion of the pediatrics paper. I discussed in another paper in Hebrew, in order not to expose Chilul Hashem, to explain the halachic background and the whole controversy on Metzitza B'Peh in the Hebrew journal HaRefuah, where a lot of details are presented about the Gemara and the Poskim and the controversy about that. I would like to share with you for the discussion some aspects. First of all, there is a new time today, since Semmelweis, might be earlier, and impressively enough, in the Gemara, to think about the concern about Sakana. The Talmud is the first source in the history of medical writing to know about hemophilia. If a family has hemophilia and they know about the hereditary pattern, Metzitza is not performed in time. That goes back 1700 years before hemophilia was described in the literature. There is a strong awareness and care and concern for the baby. Don't do Brit Milah if it is a danger. This concern for modern hygiene, since Semmelweis, all the precautions to prevent infections and clear instructions to prevent infection in every Starbucks you see when you go to the washrooms, that the employers have to wash their hands. It is standard care, not only in the operating room, emergency dentists, blood handling, absolute care. It's absolute standard. There would be no place in the world, I want to hope, where any wound healing in an operating room is done orally, with oral sucking. It's not conceivable. This whole idea is strange. True, during the time of the Gemara, Semmelweis and infectious disease were not available. Do we need a prospective study to show that comprehensively? Do we need a study of 1,000 children, perform Metzitza B'Peh, perform another one, the way we would do it for a chemotherapy? Is that the way? I think this question is answered very clearly in an excellent paper in British Medical Journal, where they have a study at the end of the year that have very humoristic papers. And they show that there is no evidence in the world that parachute use is useful to prevent death and major trauma related to gravitational challenges. Nobody proved that. It means if you didn't prove it and you don't have a control group to show that, how can you make a statement that using a parachute that costs a lot of money is indicated? And that's of course a very humoristic approach. Yes, we need evidence-based medicine, but we need also common sense. Therefore, all the shortcomings and the critics, which were sent also to the editors, are in place. The fingerprints would be helpful. But if the Mohel refuses, you can still use common sense and all the circumstantial evidence. So we don't need proofs that parachutes might be helpful. We don't need proof that oral Metzitza B'Peh today is not the ideal way when we're nowhere else in the world. In no dentist and no operating room will work like that. The second point is pure halachic understanding. I'm not the posek, but I'm allowed to open the Gemara and make my own insights and at least ask the right questions. I don't think there are many journals that like pediatrics who are willing to publish a Chtam Sofer. I was very happy to publish the Chtam Sofer. And to show that Metzitza B'Peh is not part of Mitzvat Milah. But the whole Metzitza is not part of the Mitzvah. Metzitza B'Peh isn't mentioned at all. It's true that they are gematriot, that Milah and Peh is the same gematria. But we don't work like that. Because I have many other gematriot, which I will not share, because that's not the level we do infectious disease prevention. And the Gemara is very, very clear about that. If the Mohel doesn't do what he has to be done to prevent the danger, he is fired. That's not common use for any chazan who makes a mistake. He can never be again a chazan. For the Mohel, there is no excuse and there is no compromise. He is fired the same day if he does cause any disease. Now, the responsum by the Chtam Sofer, that's a very interesting issue, which can teach us a lot of fascinating insights. There was a lot of discussions about that over the last 200 years. I'm really not the first one to report it. It comes every 5 years, another case every 10 years, and there will be, if we collect all the cases, it's true. One is syphilis, one is the other one. Dr. Reichman explained it nicely, that there are different situations where it comes up. But if we take the summary and just make a clear insight, what's the impression? It is very clear that is not the best way to treat it. Interesting that the Chtam Sofer, who wrote letters, Igrot Tshuvot, his students, once he died, he published that 2 years before he was Niftor, and this Tshuva was not published by his students for very interesting historical reasons. And I think here we come to fascinating history, questions of history, and Reform Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, Hungarian responsa. He was absolutely clear in his tshuva, which was not published by his students after his death, who collected all the other letters. His students knew better what the Chtam Sofer wanted to publish or not. That's a fascinating historical halachical insight. It was not published. I don't have the time to discuss that, but let me read one line. Ein lanu esek benistarot. We don't play around with all chibuv mitzvah, mitzitzah b'peh. If it's a danger, don't touch. He says very clearly, the same way that ispelamit is not a mitzvah, the same way that kamon is not a mitzvah, it's not a mitzvah, find another solution. And it's interesting that he was asked by a student in Vienna, the question comes from Europe, from Vienna, from Germany, and you know that the rabbis in Germany, Dr. Reichman, I'm trying to make a joke, I'm trying to learn from you. Do you know that rabbis in Germany, they have a Spitzbeltel? And the question, what is the philosophy to have a beltel, a beard like that? And the answer is very simple. If they sit with rabbis, they sit like that. But if they sit with professors, with the government, they sit like that. So the German scholars, the German rabbis, Rudolf Hoffmann, Rav Hirsch, and others, they found a very clear solution. We have a new modern instrument. That was the time after Semmelweis. We knew it's a sucking device, which has a negative pressure to perform a vacuum, to create a vacuum, and we perform a tzitzah without bepe, because nobody says it has to be done bepe. And if you drink a mitz anavim, grape juice, it doesn't mean that mitz, that the guy who sells you the mitz, he used to perform the mitz by sucking it by his mouth. Hopefully not. So mitz doesn't mean bepe at all. That is the tshuva by the Chtam Sofer. Professor Yaakov Katz wrote a beautiful analysis, historical analysis, about that. But what is important for me to take from there, as interested in clinical medicine, involved in clinical medicine, the history is very clear. The Mishnah and the Talmud are concerned about the baby and are very clear about that. Our Papa doesn't accept one compromise to endanger the baby. It is true that Ignaz Semmelweis changed the awareness how to do it. While over hundreds of years it was the best way to do it by oral mitzitza, it is certainly better today to do it another way. But I think Rav Papa would be the first one to say, if it endangers the baby, if he said once a person who doesn't do mitzitza has to be fired, Rav Papa would be the first one to say, if today somebody does mitzitza, bepeh, he has to be fired. Because if in one of a million of babies it could be done, he endangers that. There is no way that any doctor does a wound healing bepeh in any emergency room. So Chtam Sofer, to me, he saved the approach and the understanding and the spirit and the psak of the Gemara, which is so protective for the baby. When there is any reason to suspect danger, hecha de'ika lemecha shlesakanta, kol dehu. It is true that this clear approach by the Talmud and the Chtam Sofer was challenged or had experienced tremendous discussions and controversies, which I covered in the slide, but I think you should be happy to share it with you. It is true that shortly after the Chtam Sofer died, in 1844, there was an assembly of reform rabbis who wanted to change the circumcision. So some of the students, I understand them, that they got very angry and to say, we will never change the circumcision, we will never change the mitzitzah, we will never change the mitzitzah bepeh, and everything that was done should be done exactly the way it is done over the hundreds of years. And that's a very interesting approach question about the relationship between minhag and between the Gemara. There are certain minhagim which are not like written in the Gemara, and they have a certain kedusha. They have a certain value in itself because they preserve a tradition, and we are in the heritage hotel. There is a heritage. Do we have to continue a heritage which is the opposite of the Gemara? That is the question. That's the, really the question, which I feel is the underlying. Azhara hamura v'dat Torah over all the years, and as I showed you, the Tshuvot were not published. Gaon Hador, Posek Hador, Chtam Sofer was not published because students thought differently. And here I have a long list to tell you about that, but as I promised you, I thought to publish what I learned from the Mishnah and the Talmud in pediatrics, and ignored this aspect because I'm concerned about the baby only. That was published in the American Journal of Pediatrics with all the reservations I shared with you before. The editor-in-chief was Dr. Feigen, and he got many emails, which he, part of them he forwarded to me, because I think 6 weeks after my publication, a child died in New York. And Dr. Feigen, as the editor-in-chief of pediatrics and the editor of Feigen's textbook of pediatric infectious disease, I would assume he has an understanding what you can prove, what you have to prove to make a point, or to make at least a point of a suspicion, and what is statistically meaningful to think about it, at least to have the suspicion. Think about virus, treat with acyclovir. There was another paper, which I don't have to present in detail, which tried to address the question of the statistics. That's the statistics they found, that in 24 per 100,000 compared to 3.4, the risk which is increased. It's interesting to do the statistics, thousands of patients, more than that, but I think to have a common sense that I proved you with the Pertius paper, that has some support. There were controversies about that, whether it is reliable or not. The point is clear. If there is the same mohel in several cases, there is an increased risk suspicion. If it is the neonatal herpes simplex remains uncommon for the reasons I mentioned here, the symptoms appear typically at the time, the location of herpes of the herpes lesions. It is herpes simplex virus type 1. Please don't tell me. Meantime, I'm a grandfather married to a grandmother. Don't tell me, as I heard from many rabbanim and mohalim, it was the booby who right after the bris hugged the baby exactly there. I heard such claims which are totally unacceptable. Nobody touches the wound. So they showed here some... these are the papers from the other paper, Morbidity and Mortality. And I want to summarize with the slides, with the last two slides here, that the potentially danger for the neonate, if I have at the beginning a concern, a clinical concern, just treat the patient, a boy, 5 days after Mitzitza, think about antibiotics and give acyclovir. It's a very clinical decision making, add a drug. If it is herpes, you will find out in 3 days, treat. That's one message. The second message was learn the Gemara. The Gemara is totally clear of that Papa. There's nothing about the pe. It's not part of the mitzvah. I want to say that Sofek Pikuach Nefesh is Chilul Hashem. The way I looked at that and I discussed it with my rabbis, the same considerations that led the Talmudic sages to establish the custom of Metzitza for the sake of the infant could now be applied to persuade at the Mohel to use an instrumental section to avoid that. And if the Gemara says, the Mishnah says, the Pikuach Nefesh, we don't consider Ein Olchim be Pikuach Nefesh Achar HaRov, we don't consider questions of probability, it's true, it's one of a million or whatever you say, calculate. The Tosfot is clear, Shelo Yuchal Lavo B'Shum Inyan Lidei Mitat Yisrael. There should be no way that you can induce and be responsible to create that. And the Rambam says, "I efshar lahachzir nefesh achat miYisrael laolam." If a death occurs or a severe disease, there is no compromise for that. That is based on Rav Papa, and the Rambam and Tosfot are very clear about that. You will find more in the Hebrew paper, which is referred here too. Still, I know that people go skiing. I'm a big skier. I like ski, and I can do crazy ski on my cheshbon. not b'shem hadat. I know that there is a lot of controversy about that. I didn't want to violate anybody. I want to show the background on that, and I would like to finish with a beautiful prayer by Noam Elimelech. Adarava, ten belibeinu shenirei kol echad ma'alat chavereinu velo chesrono. We should respect our friends and to see the beauty and the advantage what they have, the special skills and qualities, and not to attack them. Shenedaber kol echad et chavero bederech yashar v'haratzui lefanecha. We should be straight and respectful. Ve'al yaleh belibeinu shum sinah me'echad al chavero chalila. There should be no hatred, no sinah. Ve'techazek otanu be'ahava elecha kasher galui v'yadua lefanecha. Shiakol nachat ruach elecha, we should do it with nachat ruach in a respectful way. And in this sense, I would like to thank you for your attention.
Much Rabbi Benny. So again, we won't have any questions now. We'll follow that immediately with the next two sessions. The next session will be with Dr. Berman. Interesting how things are. Dr. Berman was here last year at our conference, and doing our due diligence of reading our journals and things like that, I came across a fascinating article in Dialogue, which it's a new publication, and I looked at the title and I said, wow, I think I met this fellow. And as we were planning this event, we thought to ourselves, wow, we know Benny, we know Dan Berman, we know all these people. So why hear it, you know, secondhand, thirdhand as we read it? So it was really an exciting opportunity. So as we start thinking about this, to be able to, you know, interact and have the speakers come and speak to us directly. So from that point of view, from that personal side, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Berman. Dr. Berman, as many of you know, has become very, very popular this past year, and probably maybe more popular than he ever wanted to be. But nonetheless, he comes with credentials that are very much deserving. He's currently the chief of infectious disease at New York Westchester Square Medical Center in the Bronx. He's an attending physician in infectious disease at Montefiore. So his background, of course, makes him very credible in terms of the areas of infectious disease. I know he spent some time learning at YU. He is a physician, yet he is partly in COLEL, but I don't think he gets a stipend for the COLEL. Probably provide the stipend to the COLEL. So really, I think it's a great pleasure and honor to introduce Dr. Berman.
Okay, thank you very much, Laser. So, as Laser, actually, I've been here the last 2 years as one of the audience. So, I'm not a regular speaker in these kinds of events. It's not what I do. Next year, I think I'm going to be among you in the crowd there. But this year, I was asked to speak about a topic that I've really devoted many, many, many hours that my wife could attest to in the last 7 years. Somehow, I fell into this by accident, and I've gotten very involved. And my search has been to find out what the truth actually is. I am not ideologically committed to anything. I have three boys, Baruch Hashem. My first boy may have had Matitza Peh. I'm not sure. I didn't know what it was at the time. I know that my next two sons did not have Matitza Peh. So by no means am I ideologically committed, so that my view at it is a purely objective view to find out what the truth is. So I'm going to discuss about the medical facts about Matitza Peh. And I just want to say that Dr. Gesundheit gave a wonderful presentation. Just one point I want to make, use the word common sense. The common sense will tell you that it's dangerous. I just want to change that a little bit. I want to change that to say theoretical basis. I agree that there's a strong theoretical basis to say that there might be transmission of herpes through Matitza Peh. It's different from common sense, once there's a theoretical basis for something, then one has to observe what the reality is. And to say that, well, you haven't proved about parachutes, it's a little bit different about Matitsa Bepeh. It's been something that's been done for 2,000 years. In addition to that, New York City has been chasing this the last 10 years to try to pin down and try to prove that there's real transmission, and they have stated over and over again that there is proved transmission. So my intention here today is to discuss whether, in fact, the statements of New York City, and now endorsed by the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control of the United States, which, by the way, Tom Friedman, who is the head of the CDC, is the former head, former commissioner of the New York City Health Department at the time when they started their attack on Matitsa Bepeh. So it's kind of the same club. So we want to know, is this true that there is a proof that there is danger caused by Matitsa Bepeh? We also want to say that I wasn't asked to speak about the halacha. I was asked to speak about the medical facts. But since something that was discussed a little bit, the halacha, I'm not a rav. I don't know much. But I just want to say that there are many, many halachic opinions. You heard one halachic opinion today. And it's probably more a minority halachic opinion than the majority halachic opinion. Because if you look around, you know, there's sort of this impression that people have that Matitsa Bepeh is performed by this fringe element of crazy Hasidim. And it's not true. Matitsa Bepeh is performed in large segments of the Orthodox Jewish population. Matitsa Bepeh is done by all the Hasidic groups, including Lubavitch does it also. It's done in many of the yeshiva communities. It's done, and I know this, by the way, I've spoken to Molim all over the world. I've really tried to find out the truth about this. I spoke to Rabbanim all over the world. So it's done in the Baltimore Jewish community. It's done in the Lakewood Jewish community. Meretz Yisrael, I've been in close touch with Rabbi Steinberg, asking him many questions about the situation in Meretz Yisrael. I want to thank him publicly for being so helpful to me. And it's done in all the Haredi communities of Meretz Yisrael. It's done among the Haredi, Datin, Lumi in Meretz Yisrael. And it's done in some of the Dati Lumi communities that are not so Haredi in Eretz Yisrael. It's done in the Sephardi communities of the United States in Eretz Yisrael. And they're not so-called Haredim. So the practice of Matitsa Bepeh is a widespread practice among Orthodox Jews. I think that we get a little bit tunnel vision being in a modern Orthodox community. And I'm part of that modern Orthodox community. But the truth is that in most of the segments of the Orthodox Jewish community, it's done. And the Rabbanim are well aware of the Maran Shabbos, they're well aware of the Rambam, they're well aware of the Sam Sofer, they're well aware of all of that. But yet, they have issued SOC for their communities on how to proceed, which is not exactly what we heard this morning. Now, I also want to say that Matitsa, just describe what it is, just have a picture of what Matitsa is. I went to a lecture recently, someone described it as a licking motion. I also, Dr. Zumpe, with all due respect, we're friends, we're family, I know that. But in your article you said that there is repeated suctioning until all the blood is drawn out. And I've been to many Brisim, I've spoken to many more of them. It's not the way it's done as far as I can tell. It's a split second of, that's how it's done. So it's not a repeated, it's not licking, it's not sucking, it's not oral sex as people want to say it is. It's just a split second suction, and that's what it is. So the question is, in that split second, can something take place? I also want to say that my point of view is a mainstream point of view. People have portrayed me in the Jewish week as whatever it is. Dr. Berman, Dr. Yochid. I think I'm a mainstream point of view. The reason I say that is that the Israeli government is a commission. Rabbi Steinberg is a big part of that commission. And he has authored a point of view, a position paper on Matitsa Bepeh, which was a product of a lot of hard work between the health ministry and the chief rabbinate of the state of Israel. And that's in the syllabus. And I think if you read it, not carefully, however you want to read it, you'll see that the position is very, very similar to my position. A lot of it follows word to word. So that my position, I believe, is not an outside position. My position is a mainstream position. And again, in a document that's provided for you and authored mostly by Rav Steinberg. Now, for some background, just want to say that, I'm not going to talk much about it, but there's a history of other infections purported to be associated with Matitsa Bepeh. And so we had syphilis in the early 19th century, we had a case of tuberculosis, and there are other things. There's one typo I just want to mention, I apologize, genital lesions were 1888. And this was thoroughly worked out by Dr. Sprecher in his article in Hakira. However, since 1946, the only infection that's been discussed has been that of herpes. So despite assertions in some articles that I've seen that of infection, people talk about hepatitis B, hepatitis C, HIV, none of these have ever been shown to be transmitted, not one. So really the only question that we're dealing with, despite the theoretical basis for the possibility of transmission of infection, the only infection that we're really talking about that we need to discuss and analyze in a scientific, objective way is that of herpes. So is there really transmission of herpes? Now, in the syllabus, I have Dr. Gesundheit, a few slides about the study. I think Dr. Gesundheit described it quite well. He mentioned the strengths of the study, which is basically a few case reports of cases of babies that had herpes, neonatal herpes, and also had metitsilopet. And I think it was an important contribution to really raise the question of the possibility. And I think, as Dr. Gesundheit himself said, there's no proof from there, but it certainly raises the question, gives one cause for concern, and I think justifies a further look to see whether or not there's really transmission. So really what came to the news and brought into the public eye was a report. This is the New York City Health Department, and this was on the basis of three linked cases. So New York City Health Department at that time sent a letter to the Jewish community. It was called an open letter to the Jewish community. And in that, he wrote that there is definite proof that metitsilopet causes herpes. And he made it, and Tom Frieden authored this, and he made a strong recommendation that it shouldn't be done anymore. Now, so this was one particular mohel. There were three cases. Now, two of the cases were twins. One of the babies passed away. And the other case was a year earlier. So there were three cases in total. And New York City assumed that the mohel was the cause. Now, of course, one can just walk away and say, three cases, one mohel, case closed. However, one has to analyze it a little bit more to find out what the truth is. Again, our searches in the spirit of this conference is for everybody to search for the truth, everybody to have an open mind, and look at the facts as they really are, and not just accept things as they are from a distance. So if you look carefully, first of all, to scientifically view three cases and to say that two of them were twins, and to view them as three independent cases, just not fair. If you have one twin that has the infection, it's very easy to give the infection from one twin to the other, because anyone who's taking care of the baby can easily transmit the infection just by touching one baby and then touching the other baby. So to view them as two separate independent cases and present them as such is really intellectually unfair. By the way, it just reminds me of one thing I just want to, Dr. Gesundheit, in all due respect again, you said that about the bubby, no one touches the wound. Well, it's not true that no one touches the wound because people have to care for the wound after the surgery. So there are people touching the wound, but I'll get to that a little bit more later. But in this particular case, one baby has the herpes, one baby touches it, now has herpes on his hand, touches the other baby, it's very easy to transmit herpes. The other point is that the third baby, which was actually a year earlier, so the third baby, Rabbi Fisher, the mohel, has said many, many, many times that he did not do metitsilopet. And he's taken two polygraph tests that he did not do metitsilopet. New York City said he did, and as a matter of fact, New York City, in their study, they listed divided cases into confirmed and probable. So their definition of confirmed, you have to look at the small print and everything, their definition of confirmed was that the parent said that it was done. That was their definition. In this particular case with this baby, the New York City report did not have a single eyewitness to the metitsilopet. By the way, if you ever try to see if it was really done or not, I've asked people who are sonducts. They have no idea. No idea. You ask the father, they have no idea. So I've been to a bris. I asked the father, was it done? He said, yeah, of course it was done. I asked the mohel, no, I don't do metitsilopet. Another case, I was explaining about the mohel. I know your mohel, he always uses a tube. So I didn't see any. So what tube? What do you, so even with the tube, he couldn't see it. So as far as what goes on, people, the sonda, no one can, so quick the whole thing, so no one can really see what's going on. But in this particular case, the one eyewitness New York City had, even he admitted that he didn't see it. He saw the mohel bend down quickly and come back up. So that was the third case. So the assumption is by New York City that the mohel is a liar. The assumption is that it was done. I mean, just not fair to do that and call that a confirmed case. And again, two polygraphs tests. So I think it's a reasonable assumption that he said he didn't do it, passed the polygraph test. There's no witness to contradict that, so it wasn't done. Furthermore, if you look carefully at where the rash was, also these cases, go back a step, these cases weren't clean cases. So in one case of the twins, the baby had an identified rash before the meal. This is not made up. This was confirmed on the medical record that the baby went to a pediatrician beforehand for a rash on the buttock. Now, I'm not suggesting that that was the herpes, but it's quite possible that the rash on the buttock created skin that was now susceptible to infection by herpes. It's known about the natural history of herpes that the virus is transmitted easily through cracked skin. So you have the conditions to have it transmitted. And then someone who's touching the baby can transmit in that area. And in fact, it first presented as lesions in the area of the buttocks. So that we are presented. And also in the Staten Island case, in that third case, it was also presented actually in the thigh. And then the herpes developed later on there. So it's not clear at all that, as Rabbi Mazuntai's cases, where it seemed to start on the genitalia, it wasn't clear at all in these cases. And the other point I want to say about this mohel, that he had done thousands of brisim before that without any problem, one of the busiest molim around. So you have to explain why for thousands of brisim he had no problems, then all of a sudden there are three cases. So I think to say anything about these three cases, there's nothing there at all. So this was really the bombshell that came out. So I wrote my article last year. I spent last summer writing it. I thought, okay, interesting. It was a quiet. I didn't know what was going to happen afterwards as far as the storm that was going to happen afterwards. But this CDC report came out. So the CDC report came out a couple months ago. So this was based on a New York City investigation that was being done. New York City had decided to start investigating this in April 2006. So they started, this report was based on from April 2006 through December 2011. And also they went back and looked at the cases that they had before that they knew about. Now, first of all, again, Rabbi Mazuntai, Dr. Mazuntai, I just want to object to one thing. So, another thing. Anyway, you talk about cases being underreported. That's been a big claim that's been made. They're underreported. And in fact, in that article, Pediatrics, there's the phrase tip of the iceberg. So, a lot of people believe that. There's been many, many more cases. And I think New York City believed that also. So, in April 2006, they made it into a reportable disease. So, that means that every case was now being reported. So, I think it's common sense. Or there's a theoretical basis to say that if you had a certain number of cases before it was mandatory reporting, then once it's mandatory reporting, you should have a lot more cases. If it was true that there were cases that were underreported, then we were seeing the tip of the iceberg. But as a matter of fact, from 2000 through April 2006, there were a total of six cases, maybe. And then from April 2006 through December 11, there were five cases, maybe. So that the number of cases, after it was now mandatory, was exactly the same. So to say that there was underreporting, I think, is just not supported by the evidence. Now, in this case, the first point I want to highlight is that there were 84 cases of neonatal herpes during this mandatory period. Now, first of all, people focus on the five cases, maybe, of boys who had the T-cell-mediated herpes. During this time, there were 79 other children who had neonatal herpes. Why does no one care about those 79 children? Those 79 children, every one of them caught the infection from another person. The CDC, the New York City Health Department, should be worried, how did this happen? How can we let this happen? But the focus was on the five. Now, you can say, okay, maybe that's all herpes two. Well, it's not. Because as a matter of fact, we had 37 cases of herpes one, and we had 33 cases of herpes 2 and 14 untyped. By the way, New York City viewed untyped as the same as herpes 1. Herpes 1 is the one that we're interested in, that we think that there is transmission. So they grouped them together. So since 2000, there were nine cases altogether of type 1, and there were two cases of untyped. But also, I want to make the point that there were 25 cases. During the period, there were five cases, boys on the T-cell. There were 25 cases among boys who did not have Matitsa Pet. So you have to account and give a mechanism for 25 other boys, and you also have to give a mechanism for the 21 girls who got neonatal herpes 1. So it's clear. It's clear there are 46 other cases. It's clear that there are many ways to get herpes transmission, and it's not only through Matitsa Pet. Now, just to go over the 11 cases, which goes back to 2000. So there were six cases in the first period and five cases in the second period. So in the first period of the six cases, there were four that were confirmed and two were probable. And of the six, one was untyped and five were herpes one. In the second period of five cases, so then there were actually only two that were confirmed, three that were probable, and only of the five, there were four that were confirmed to be HSV1, and one was untyped. So only one of the confirmed cases actually was HSV1. And remember, just what I said about confirmed, that in the case of that third case of that one mohel, confirmed was that the parent said so, even though the mohel said he didn't do it. So I'm not sure what the confirmed cases actually mean. Now, so the CDC came up with their conclusions, and they thought that this was sufficient to demonstrate that the mitzvah peg caused herpes. So the way they looked at it, they made a mathematical, statistical calculation. So they said that there were 25 cases among the, they estimated there were 350,000 boys who did not have mitzvah peg. This estimate was based upon school studies done by Marvin Schick. So they made this estimation, and they said that since there were 25 cases out of 350,000, that's an incidence of 7.1 per 100,000. They said then that among the boys who had mitzvah peg, they estimated there were 20,000, they should have been the same incidence, right? 7.1 per 100,000. Since they estimated there were 20,000, 20,000 is a fifth of 100,000, so a fifth of 7.1 should be 1.46. So there should have been 1.5 cases. What did they find? They found that there were 5 cases. So you can't have a half a case. So we're talking about then 3 or 4 extra cases over a period of 6 years. So that's what we're talking about. So the question is there any statistical significance to the fact that there were 3 or 4 extra cases during this time? And the answer is, I've checked with statisticians about this, the answer is no. And I'm going to show you a slide soon that New York City, a year earlier, when they published their data just a year before, said there's absolutely no statistical significance to their numbers. Now, the CDC, to buttress their argument, aside from statistical analysis, they came up with certain circumstantial facts to prove their case. They said that the transmission from the mother or healthcare workers was largely excluded. Just pay attention to that. They didn't say anything about family members. They said that the timing of onset was consistent with that it was gotten from a mitzvah peg, and also that the location of the lesions was consistent with acquisition from a mitzvah peg. So again, I just want to give Tom Friedman statements. This back in 2005, so he made the statement that they were sure that was based on the 3 cases. And now after this report, the same Tom Friedman in the MMWR report, this was the report of the CDC published in their weekly bulletin called the MMWR. So they said the findings of this investigation and previously published reports are consistent with a cause and effect relationship between Jewish ritual circumcision with direct oral genital suction and neonatal herpes. Now let's look at these cases. Now first of all, when you have such a small number of cases, so any change in that case, if it goes down one, the denominator changed a little bit, the numerator changed a little bit, anything that you change a little bit is going to mess up the calculation. And to begin with, even given their numbers on a mathematical analysis, it doesn't bear out to have any statistical significance. But even if you assume to do it, you have to look at these cases, and you can change the numerator or denominator very easily. Now, first of all, we know in one of the 5 cases, the case that also was a big thing in the news in September, baby died. So this baby had a prolonged and intimate exposure to a sibling. So the 2-year-old sibling, when the baby was 4 days old, this I know from personal investigation, I'm not making this up. This I spoke to the mother, I reviewed the chart, so I've done my own personal investigation into these cases and not accept things at face value, the way newspapers report it, or the way New York City reports it. So in this case, the sibling who was 2 years old with recurrent active herpes, who had active herpes on his lip at the time, spent 1.5 hours with the baby when the baby was 4 days old. Now, if this was a baby who did not have the teats of a pet, no one in the world, through common sense, would say this is not how it was caused. Common sense clearly says that this is how it was caused. Yet, New York City insisted that this was another case of a herpes death caused by the teats of a pet. Also, if you look at the 5 cases, there were 2 brothers. So 2 brothers from the same family, one in 2008, one in 2011. There were no cases in New York City in 2009, 2010, any child, any mohel. So to say that there was some big coincidence that these 2 brothers got it from the mohel and the mohel didn't give it to anybody else, no other mohel gave it to anybody else during this period, I think it's much more plausible to say that the 2 brothers, either both of them got it from a family member, which is the most likely route of transmission in these cases, as we have in this case of the baby with the sibling. There's another case which was in the first period, the non-mandatory period of the 6 cases, where it's known that the mother had an active herpes sore on her lip when she was taking care of the wound and dressing the baby and not washing her hands. New York City knew this also, by the way. But in any case, so that's 2 more of the cases out of the 5. So out of the 5, we have the baby in September with the sibling. We have the 2 brothers. We also know that there's a UGA study that came out, you may have seen it in the New York Times and Jewish Week, that there's been explosion of births in the Orthodox Jewish population, so much so that 75% of Jewish children in New York City are now Orthodox. So I think that the number of cases on the teats of the pen among boys in New York City may be grossly underestimated. Now, as far as the other supporting pieces of information that New York City used to prove their case, so one was the exclusion of mother and healthcare workers. Now, the way that they excluded the mother and healthcare workers was that they did not have active lesions. So the same criteria to exclude them was not used to exclude the MOHEL. So the MOHEL, even if he didn't have, none of the MOHEL had active lesions. That wasn't a criteria used. It could not be used to exclude the MOHEL, yet it was used to exclude the mother and healthcare workers. Now, how they cannot consider other family members or context of the baby is really, I just don't understand at all. I mean, a baby, just think of the situation. So we have a situation of a baby in the hospital. Right? Baby in the hospital, everyone's wearing gowns and gloves, and there are all kinds of infection control rules to prevent any kind of transmission. The baby is discharged and goes home. There's no more gowns. There's no more gloves. There's no more anything. There's no more infection control. There's a baby being touched by everybody. And for someone to think through common sense that is not or a theoretical basis that there's not a chance for this baby to get infected by someone who's shedding virus, because after all, the theory of those who say that it's transmitted through mosquito pet is by this shedding virus of someone who's asymptomatic. Well, first of all, you can have even those who are symptomatic, because you have the case of the mother, you have the case of the brother. And unfortunately, in this trying to pin everything on the teats of the pet, it's unfortunate that parents are not being taught and people aren't being taught about the dangers of herpes and someone known to have herpes. So these mothers didn't know it. They had no idea that a sibling or a mother with a herpes lesion could transmit the virus. So this is, I think, a real shortcoming of everything going on, that all these cases that are preventable and no one's teaching them anything about it, it's all about the teats of a pet. By the way, I just want to make another point about the numbers, extremely important point, about screening bias. And again, Rabbi Gesundheit, forgive me for mentioning the article again and what you taught, but you did say that when you hear that there's a kid who having teats of pet, your antennas is up for herpes. You said that. Now, the diagnosis of herpes is not a diagnosis that declares itself. So we don't know about every case of herpes. The baby doesn't come in and say, I have herpes. So to have the diagnosis, the doctor has to think about it, and then the appropriate tests have to be made. So that if you have a kid comes in with having teats of a pet, everybody's all worked up, herpes, 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 herpes. So you're going to do a lot more tests looking for herpes. If a kid comes in from wherever, never had the teats of a pet, not a Jewish kid, has a little sore, if it comes to the doctor, the pediatrician will say, put a little Bassett tracing on it. So there's a strong screening bias. So you're much more likely to make the diagnosis in the population of kids who had the teats of a pet. So for a couple more cases that you had over the 5-year period, that itself could explain that. Now, as far as the onset of symptoms in the incubation period, so there's really nothing specific about it. I mean, the general incubation period is described as between 2 and 12 days. There's one case that had 20 days. So it's so broad that you can't pin it down to one day to say, oh, it had to be at the 8th day. I mean, that, you just can't do that. It could be anywhere along the line from birth to 2 weeks later. You can't make anything out of that. And in fact, there were 13 fatalities reported in New York City from April 2006 through December 2010. By the way, none of them had the teats of a pet. And 5 had an incubation period that's consistent with infection at age day 8. So you can't make anything out of that. Now, the distribution of lesions, I talked about the twins, that really the lesions were all over. And in the case of the baby that died in September, so I looked at this chart. I read it 100 times. I do change one thing that I wrote. That is actually, there was one examination of two of a nurse that said that there were blisters on the scrotum. But every doctor who examined this patient described no lesions on the penis or on the scrotum. The closest was on the groin. So the most consistent was on the foot and one in the groin and one in the abdomen. There was not one doctor described anything on the penis or the scrotum, despite the city's assertion that it was on the genitalia. Now, this is important to point out, that New York City actually published its results a year earlier. They published this in a journal of sexually transmitted diseases. And they said at the end that our study has several limitations. This is New York City. The relatively limited number of cases limits the ability to make definitive statistical comparisons among our cases and to those reported in other case theories and make certain statistical analyses unstable. What changed in 1 year? So this is what they reported. And this was in a peer-reviewed journal. So I think they were forced to admit that their statistics didn't bear out anything. A year later, in the CDC report, everything was perfect. Now, they didn't address the question of how they achieved statistical significance. I've checked again with statisticians, and it doesn't seem to be much of a difference between that time and a year later. Now, why wouldn't herpes be transmitted? So one thing that I mentioned about the time, it's a split second. This is going to the common sense. About 5 minutes? That's it? Now? 4 minutes? Okay. Okay, then there's the wine and Listerine. And then about the suctioning, that's really, it's doing that and it's not pouring saliva out. Now, I'm just showing this punch. The reason for the punch is that I think that this is the closest clinical model to Matisse's pet. This is someone punches someone in the mouth. So there is a laceration and there's a moment of contact with saliva. And I've seen many times this infection of the hand, and it's the bacterial infection. So the Matisse of the pet, if there's a risk of infection, the first infection you should see is bacterial infection. The threshold for that is much lower. We never see herpes in this situation. So if you're going to tell me that you're going to jump over to herpes infections, you must be seeing lots of bacterial infections, and we just don't see that. Another point I want to make is about Listerine. New York City said that Listerine doesn't do anything. I don't know why they say that, because it's shown that the Listerine can kill the virus. And certainly common sense would tell you that it's reasonable to use it, and it should prevent, if there is any low incidence of infection. So in conclusion, I want to say that there's no proof linking it. I should point out the gold standard, which is DNA fingerprinting, has never been done. And really, the number of cases is too small for any statistical significance. And again, as I just, you know, if you want to know what really goes on, so you go to where they do the most Matisse of the past. I asked Rabbi Steinberg, and he related to me how many cases there are. So in the last 4 years in Eretz Yisrael, there are about 15 to 20,000 Matisse's done per year. There have been 7 suspected cases. 4 were shown to be not. And 2 of them, it looked like the mother probably had herpes. So maybe 2 cases. And again, you could find other reasons. And again, this is just repeating the position of the paper of Rabbi Steinberg. So the last point I want to make, then I'm done, one more minute. The last point I want to make is that if someone wants to attack Matisse of the pet and say it shouldn't be done, that the government should interfere, what they're really saying is that bris mila also shouldn't be done the way we do it. The argument is that it violates principles of infection control. Bris mila outside of a hospital violates all the principles of infection control. To say that you can do an operation in a shul, in a living room, with 100 people crowded around the surgeon, violates every principle of infection control. And is there risk? Absolutely there's risk in bris mila. So if you want to use those criteria, that there's risk, and also that violates infection control, we should never be doing any bris mila anymore. Furthermore, as Dr. Zuntai said, the 8th day, the immune system is very weak. No way we should be doing the bris mila on the 8th day. We should wait until the baby's a year old, the immune system is fully developed. We make allowance for bris mila because we think there's enough religious significance to make allowance for it. Matisse of a pet, among those who hold it, has religious significance. And they have a right to do that, and they're the biggest rabbonim in the world who believe that is part of an important part of our religion. So as we have deference for bris mila to allow certain things, violating infection control, putting babies at some risk, there's no reason not to allow this. I've shown clearly that there may be risk. But if there is, it's rare and slight. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berman. We'll move along now with our next speaker. I want to make sure that everybody understands the Rabbi Glatt, who will be speaking now. Sometimes we refer to, I'm thinking, the Neshnek Suva Machishim Zed, Zed Shiova Kosova Shishi Vayachriya Beinehem. Rabbi Glatt is not being the Machriya Beinehem. I want that to be very clear. We're having two positions here that you heard are somewhat different. There's some overlap, there's some areas. When we designed this for this morning, Rabbi Glatt was not going to be. That was not the intention, and that's not the role. Why do I say that? Because it's a pleasure for me to introduce Rabbi and Dr. Glatt, because as you who have been here in the past, have known that I've called upon Dr. Glatt to deal with some of these very challenging areas. 2 years ago, the RCA came out with a statement with regards to brain death, and that was the controversy, and that was the hot topic 2 years ago. Last year, we challenged the audience with the issue of the homosexual individual and the community response. And once again, I call Rabbi Dr. Glatt to come in there and help deal with us, deal with the tough issues. As you can see, this is a very difficult issue. And the issues that surround it really are much more than Matitza Bepeh, because as we heard last night, when we get into issues of government intervention and restriction of practice and things of that nature, the question becomes, what service are we doing to our own community? Is this battle and this controversy, can it be kept into the hallowed halls of the Beis Medrash and or the amphitheater? Or does it have, you know, a ripple effect beyond that? And so if people and organizations start seeing, oh, the Jews themselves are having this kind of conversation, this is a very good and opportune time to be able to seize the moment. San Francisco, Germany, Switzerland, I don't have to go beyond, and this is in our own times. So without further ado, Rabbi Dr. Glatt, who has been with us many years, is an assistant rabbi at the Congregation Anshei Chesed at the Young Israel of Woodmere. Also one of these, I don't know how 24 hours of the day does justice to an individual, giving the Daf Yomi Shiur for 2 decades. He is the executive vice president of a hospital. He's on the teaching staff at New York Medical College, has written hundreds of papers, authored books, finds time to spend time in a meaningful way with his family and to give up some of his time. It's a pleasure to call on Rabbi Dr. Glatt. I just remind you again that some questions and some comments, please put them onto some paper. After Rabbi Glatt's talk, we'll have the panel. Please already start thinking about that, and we'll be collecting them.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. After those 2 very passionate and excellent presentations, I do have a difficult job in trying to put some perspective, not to be machria, as was just mentioned. But first and foremost, 2 things. One, post mechvod achsanya, Rabbi Jay Kelman and his wonderful Eishes Chayil, and Dr. Lazer Friedman and his wonderful Eishes Chayil have put in a tremendous amount of time and effort to make this such a beautiful program. And they deserve a big Yashar Koach from everybody. It certainly is intellectually stimulating. It's Harbat Sas Torah. It's a wonderful kosher way for people to socialize and get together. And Yitzhak Shem should do this at May of the Yesser. Next year in Lake Placid, July 4th to 7th. And then on a personal note, it gives me great, great Hakaras HaTov to wish my wife a very happy anniversary. She somehow managed to put up and tolerate somebody for 32 years. That in and of itself is a huge accomplishment. So, the Matzitza Bepeh controversy continues, and Laser, how do I get it to go to the next slide? I'm pressing the next button. Okay, what are we talking about today? So the 2 things I was asked to specifically look at and address are from a perspective on how should we as Shomer Torah Mitzvah Jews, how should we as people who are very interested in Emes L'Yakov, interested in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's names, Chosin Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Emes, how are we supposed to deal with an issue where it appears or could potentially appear that science and halacha seem to collide or may have a difference in terms of what would be the ideal way to do this if you look at one alone? And how are we supposed to represent ourselves to secular, totally a-religious, both Jews and non-Jews, in terms of presenting our position as Shomer Torah Mitzvah Jews who are interested in doing the right thing? So, I'll give very, very brief background. Most of the major points that I would have given as background have already been said. We know there's a mitzvah to be mal a person on the 8th day. As has been pointed out, that's a dangerous activity. Nobody would do this. In fact, you have some of the mafarshim that have actually commented this is a barbaric activity if it wasn't for the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu said so. And therefore, it becomes a beautiful thing to do. Durachadach and Noam, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is perfect. There can be absolutely nothing wrong with anything that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says for us to do. It is by definition impossible for direct commandment from HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be bad. Gamzu, Lutova, everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu does for us is good. So by definition, this can't be bad. Even though, scientifically, nobody would say to do a milah on day 8 is an appropriate medical intervention. Now, that's not to say that there isn't a tremendous amount of evidence to suggest that Mila is an appropriate medical intervention in the field of HIV. I believe that there are sufficient studies to recommend as a mechanism to prevent HIV transmission, circumcision. We could argue at what point that should be done. Day 8, day 80, 8 years, 18 years, but there's certainly sufficient medical advice recommendation that circumcision can be a useful tool in the prevention of HIV transmission. That's not why HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to do this, but we have to always remember a little humbleness, a little humility. Maybe we don't know everything. That's an important factor to keep in mind. We have a commandment to heal ourselves. Rapo yirape, physicians have the right to heal. We have an obligation today. Everybody has to follow halacha lemaisa. If you're sick, you got to go to the doctor. You have to take care of yourself. You're not allowed to rely upon tefillah. You're not allowed to rely upon getting kvittles. You have to do hishtaglus to get yourself better. And then we have an obligation. We're not allowed to stand idly by when we see something, Rahman al-Tzan, happy to somebody else. We have an obligation to go and try to help that person out. Let's look at the controversy. I quote to you the things that I'm interested in discussing today. I'm not going to get into the scientific background. I'll show you a paper that I wrote on this. You're welcome to look there to see my personal opinion. And I'll mention certain areas where I do have to tell you my personal opinion on this subject. There are opinions on this subject. Not everything is a clear-cut fact. Statement, again, from the MMWR, that Dr. Danny, who I can't believe we grew up 3 blocks away from each other, went to school together, played ball together here, speaking 50 years later together in a symposium. It's an honor to be on the panel with you, Danny. Circumcision is a surgical procedure that can transmit infection if not performed under sterile conditions. I don't think anybody would quibble with that. I think that's a fair statement. Can. Very rarely does. Nobody under any paper published or under any guise says that circumcision is a high-risk infection likelihood outcome if you do circumcision. Potential, yes. Nobody's demonstrated for any type of, forget herpes simplex, for any type of complication, considering the amount of soft tissue lacerations and cuts to get infected, considering the amount of wound infections after sterile, non-emergency surgery, the amount of wound infections that occur, circumcision certainly has to be one of the lowest surgical procedure infection rates that exist under the sun. I think that's an indisputable fact. MMR again said an association, very important to keep very precise wordage. There is an association at best described with direct oral genital suction. It's important that we use the right terms. Mitzitza v'peh can be fulfilled, as you'll see, according to many poskim, without direct, or what I will call matzitza b'peh mamish, or direct or genital contact. So we have to be very precise with our definitions, and I'll try to be as precise as possible. I'm quoting and underlining the words. There's an association with those 11 cases that nobody is claiming is a direct proof. The incidence, and it's estimated, as Danny, Dr. Berman certainly pointed out, that is an estimated risk. I underlined the word estimated. It is fraught with both statistical and scientific challenges. What concerns me, and what I'm going to be speaking about, and this is a quote from the MMWR, which I think every single religious person, whether they're Jewish or not, should be extremely concerned about. As going on in the background of the United States with Obamacare and accountable care organizations, can we force people to do things that go against their religious wishes? The Catholic Church right now has a huge lawsuit out against the United States government because the Catholic Church is being forced to provide medical care for things that they feel are wrong from their Catholic doctrine. Whether we agree or disagree with that Catholic doctrine is totally irrelevant. Religion has become under attack. An observance of religion has become under attack. And this statement from the MMR concerns me very much. To protect infants' health, public health department, to prevent infants' health, public health departments might need to take legal measures to cease the practice of direct oral genital suction. That's a quote. I'm not messing up anybody's words. I'm not trying to put words in anybody's mouth. What this paper is suggesting, postulating, what others have already written into legislature in the United States and in places around the world who have attempted to write into legislature and put into fact, is that public health or government has the right to abrogate religious practice. Now, I haven't discussed whether we agree with that religious practice or not. If it's Catholic doctrine, we don't really care about their religious practice. But what we're talking about is the right of a government to abrogate your individual right to practice your religion. Can't be hotter off the press than this. July, last month, a few weeks ago, the Department of Health in New York City had a discussion, proposed amendment to the New York City Health Code. These are all direct quotes. I'm not trying to put a spin on anything. I'm trying to point out a concern that I have, and I hope that everybody in this room has. New York City Department of Health is proposing, this is a proposal, to change New York City Health Code law requiring written consent for Matzitza B'Peh Mamish. The Moel would be obligated to go, or the person doing the Matzitza. I was joking around before, I had the answer to the entire problem. Think just like we have San Bikshani, we have the one, I saw a new kibbutz at a chasana, can I know how you, Vlad Rabbein. So, we're honoring him with Levisha Sakitl. He gets to put the kittel on the chasana. So I think we should create, it would be for economic stimulus package, we should create designated motzitzim. They could undergo serological testing 5 times a day with rapid diagnostic kits, and we can verify that within the last half hour, which then they could, of course, take Listerine and have an intravenous solution of Listerine going through the mouth, and we can guarantee with a new keyboard that we could give to all the motzitzim at the Mila, and we could solve the entire problem. It would stimulate the economy, it would create jobs for Kol Yungalite that could be designated motzitzim. Everybody would be happy. They want the Moel, the person doing the tzitza, to obtain written consent. They're forcing the Moel to go and say and do something which he doesn't believe is true. He doesn't believe that there's any risk, and they're forcing him to obtain a written consent against his halachic perspective. Whether that's right or not, I haven't gotten to yet. The written consent would document, require the Moel to document, that the patient has been informed of the risk of transmission. What happens if you disagree with that? They're not giving you a choice to say, check this box, I disagree with that informed consent. The Department of Health is essentially proposing, July 2012, in New York City, to go and mandate something that not everybody agrees with, and certainly people from a religious perspective might disagree with. Whatever your position, you could be a 100% pro Benny Gesundheit, you could be a 100% pro Danny Berman. That should scare you. That should terrify you. And what I think everybody's trying to do, put a square peg in a round circle. How does religion and medicine relate? Are the two opposite? So, how do we? I like to consider myself a scientist. I published, I like to look at things from the pure scientific point of view, but everything's framed through the prism of halacha. I'm not a Jew for 12 hours a day and a scientist for 12 hours a day. Anochi Ivri, it's the famous words of the Navi. I'm a Jew. Everything is reviewed through that prism. Halacha is God-given. Science is God-given. They can't conflict. It's by definition impossible for science to conflict with a d'oraisa. In the Rabbanans, we can make mistakes. But a d'oraisa cannot be something that conflicts with science. It's just impossible. So, what I'm going to speak about is how should a Torah or mitzvah person, how should a person who is an erlicha person, supposed to react to all this? Now, I had the opportunity, when the first articles were published in Pediatrics a number of years ago, there were two case reports that were published probably, I think, in 2000 or so. And I had the opportunity to write an editorial for Pediatrics on the subject. I was called to see if I wanted to write an editorial. You know, publish or perish, hey, it sounds like a great idea. More than happy to do it, I told them. But then I asked the Shiloh. I said, this is a smart thing to do. And I was told, no. Let it die down. Lav Dafka, is there a requirement for us to go and put into the secular press every single thing that we think is right from a Torah or Mitzvah's perspective? Because sometimes it will cause a Chilul Hashem, or it will cause problems. Eizehu Chacham HaRoah Es HaNolad. Who is the smart person, the one who can see into the future? I heard from my Rebbeinu, a beautiful insight. I think this was said about one of the Brisker dynasty. I don't remember exactly who, but the idea, you can apply this to many, many different scions of Judaism. One of the Gedolim said, I'm a Gadol, I can see 20 years into the future. My father, he was a Gadol, he could see 100 years into the future. When Moses Mendelssohn said, it's a good idea to go and make some changes in the way that we fulfill Torah mitzvos, I heard from my Rebbein, he never missed the Mincha B'tzibur. He's an Orthodox Jew. He got, I'm sure, the local award at his local dinner. He was the person everybody looked up to and said, that's what I want to be when I grow up. But he didn't have the ability to see into the future. And all the people that said, it's a good idea to have people drive to shul on Shabbos. It's a good idea to put the organ into the shul. It's a good idea to move the mechitza. It's a good idea to move the bima. All of them came from the right place. The heart was in the right place, but unfortunately they were blind. They didn't have the ability to see into the future. And that's why Gedolei Yisrael, who were given a certain siyata d'shmaya, given a certain perspective, they're able to see more into the future and to say that, yeah, it makes a lot of sense, but we don't think you should be doing this. I certainly don't have that vision. But some of my rabbeim do. And Gedolei Yisrael certainly do. And that's the perspective that I come from. And one of the things you have to do is avoid public controversy sometimes that's not going to have a toelis. Doesn't mean that we should sit back and allow ourselves to be smacked. Doesn't mean we should sit back and allow things to be done to us that we don't want done to us. But there's a public way and there's sometimes a private way. Yaakov Avinu, when he prepared to fight with Esav Ochiv, right? So he divided up the camp. He did things in different ways. And because I'll learn out messages for all generations how we're supposed to fight Esav. Esav Sonius Yaakov. The entire controversy with Bris Milah for the last 3,500 years is all about Esav Sonius Yaakov. I'm convinced about that. It's all underpinnings of anti-Semitism. You see in San Francisco with the campaign that they had, they put on the ballot to get rid of the Tzitzit of the Peg, get rid of circumcision. It's vile anti-Semitism. The Germans, Yimach Shemam Zichron, couldn't have done a better job of the anti-Semitism publicity that they did in San Francisco. The vile pictures of the Moyel. Sotom would be impressed that they used his image there for the Moyel. It's all underpinnings of anti-Semitism. If we don't realize that and see that, and we get caught up, is there a risk? Is there not a risk? And that's all we're focusing on. We're missing the boat. We're totally missing the boat. Avoid Chilul Hashem. Not exactly a brilliant insight, but absolutely true. Make a Kiddush Hashem. I've unfortunately been also involved in this in many ways. I've been asked to speak at various departments of health, speak at different Beis Dins and stuff like that. The bottom line is to be Erlich, is to know to say what you know, to know to say what you don't know, and to have respect. I want to read you a comment that Roshach the Shlita, one of my great rabbis, quotes in the name of the Rav Zatzar, Rav Yoshev Esalavetra, about Metzitza B'peh. Pamachas, Rotzah HaMoyal Lassos Metzitza B'peh. The Rav, Rav Yoshev Esalavetra, I happen to know this incident was occurring by Rabbi Fabian Scholfeld, Zozun Zayn Mishtak, he should continue to have a continued Rufua Shleima, a wonderful, major, major Rav in the United States for many, 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 many years. This was his son's Mila. The Rav was there, and the Moyel wanted to do Metzitza B'peh. Rabbi Schoenfeld is a Hasidic background. wanted to do Matzitz of the Pet. The Rav didn't want to. Bikshu Rabbeinu, Rav Shechter is writing this, the Rav, Rav Yosef Soloveitchik, Shlo Yas, he begged him, please don't do this. The Moel said, we do this. Where I come from, we do this. Hitzir HaMoel B'dover, the Moel insisted, again, certain level of chutzpah, in my opinion. You have the Rav Yosef Soloveitchik telling you not to do something, I don't think I would have the ability to go against that, even if I felt he was wrong. The Rav is the Rav. Right? A Gadol B'Torah has to have a certain level of respect, even if you disagree with him. Nevertheless, the Moel did it. The greatness of the Rav. What did the Rav say? Ilu hayo oviv hagromer Moshe Soloveitchik no chachiv. My father, this is the Rav talking, his father, Moshe Soloveitchik, had been present. He would have removed the Moel. Moshe Soloveitchik was stark. You think the Rav was stark from what I heard from Larry Bain. Moshe Soloveitchik was starker. Said he wouldn't have let the Mila go on with that person. B'shumofi, never would have allowed it to. What did the Rav say? Aval ani ma'od tolerant. I'm very tolerant. He let the Mila do it. Interesting. Tolerance for other opinions. I think the Rav was capable of paskening the halacha. I think the Rav is a recognized Gadol B'Yisrael. Even Baruch Hashem nowadays, even the people that didn't agree with him in lifetime are, yes, achrei mos kedoshim. The Rav is at least beginning to become acknowledged for the Rav that he was, even in the other camps of the world. Tolerant, ani ma'ot tolerant, is a basic philosophical approach that we have to have. Why are we slogging it out with each other in public? Beis Medrash is the place where Beis Hillel, Beis Shammai argue, but outside they went to each other's chasanas. They practiced Judaism together. They put their arms around each other together, even as they halachically called their other children Manzerim, which was the machlokas that they were having. But they still attended the chasana. They still survived and lived together. They didn't have public outcries in front of the goyim. Every time we put ourselves in front of the goyim, it just spurs anti-Semitism. We have to be aware of that. Esav, Somei, Yaakov, they look for every opportunity to go and get us. Avoid public controversy is my philosophy that I have for my rabbi. However, don't be afraid to defend our principles. 100%. Great rabbi would have gone to jail. Great rabbanim have given them a serious snapshot, given up their lives for our principles. For bris milah. Correct, inaccurate information. Because the CDC put something out doesn't mean it's right. Okay, my professors taught me in medical school 50% of what you're going to learn is wrong. Your trick is to figure out which 50%. 50% is wrong. So the CDC articles, there's a lot of garbage in there, as has been accurately pointed out. There's good stuff in there too. We can't ignore theoretical concerns. But we have to do it in a way that allows us to be shovel Torah mitzvahs across the board. Oops. Yeah, okay. Quickly, sources in halacha. You've heard most of them. There's historical perspective, halacha positions. I was asked to speak a little bit about risk-taking, but I wanted to focus actually on what I've done till now. And then I want to talk about some halacha l'maaseh. I have the interesting position of being a practicing rabbi in a shul. And I get asked this question, not as a posek, but I get asked the question, what should I do? Well, my bris is tomorrow, mazel tov. Do we have this mall or not have that mall? So I get to answer these questions on a real-life level, and I get a lot of these questions because people know I'm an infectious disease expert. So I get these questions very frequently, and I have to posken them, even though I don't posken on a broad basis. I posken what my rebbeim say. So I don't really posken. I'm a secretary, a shaliach, from what my rebbeim say. The sources have already been pointed out. I would add just one thing over here. There is a diktuk, or language thing. Some make a distinction between mayitz and motzitzin, that motzitzin implies a direct oral suctioning from the mouth, as opposed to mayitz, mitz, as was pointed out, may imply an indirect. I'm not going to get into it. For those that are interested in how mitzitz befez form, Dr. Gesundheit did a beautiful slide illustration, beautiful to understand the actual parameters. You should call it to that presentation as well. And I had published something on this. I published it in a place that's not so popular, so it doesn't get known. To a very large extent, it precedes what Dr. Berman published. I think that the scientific proof is very, very circumstantial. And I may not be totally of the opinion that there is zero risk. I think the risk is minimal. I think the risk has not been proven by any means as a gold standard. But I'm also choshesh for the risk. Am I rabbeim a choshesh for the risk? There's a difference between being choshesh for a risk and then coming out with public statements that it can't be done. So for those that want, it's in the book, you can see my opinions on the subject. The historical perspective I spoke about is critical in terms of understanding why this controversy keeps on coming up. I won't go through this. Most of this has already been discussed. I put it there really for historical. But since Aner, Eshkol, and Mamre, the Goyim had not been in favor of circumcision. They were Avram's friends. They gave him advice how to do the circumcision, when to do the circumcision. But since then, the Goyim had not been our best friends when it comes to circumcision. Halachic positions. Before I can tell you what you can do, what you can't do, you have to understand the different halachic positions. And I'm trying to give you the full gamut over here. There are really four, if you wish, basic shitas in the poskim. You can agree or disagree with them, but they exist. You can't ignore any of the shitas, they're all gdolei Yisrael. The opinion that Dr. Gesundheit certainly articulated so beautifully is that it's more medicinal, it's not halachically essential. That's the Teferis Yisrael to a large extent. There are very, very, very few poskim that paskim that halacha l'maisa today that you shouldn't do some form of mitzitza, albeit they say do it mitzitza without peh mamish, do indirect suctioning. But that is a far extreme position that it's absolutely medicinal, has zero hashkafic, halachic intention other than medicinal. That's one extreme position. There's another very common position accepted, is that it's essential. Mitzitza, bepet, is essential. However, it can be performed in any way. You can do it via an instrument, via manual pressure with a sponge. You can do it through a sfug. You can do it through a shofaris. You can do it with a suction machine. The action of sucking is essential, but the mechanism via which it's done is not essential. And that's in a perfectly valid, halachically accepted opinion. That would probably be the opinion that many of the poskim in the modern Orthodox world would probably promulgate. It is essential via math, direct or indirect, and that would imply that you can't use a machine to do it. You must use your mouth, but it can be indirect via the mouth. And again, that is, again, really the second and third are almost the same. And that would be the position that the RCA has said is perfectly acceptable without excluding the other positions. The RCA being the Rabbinical Council of America, of the rabbis, that belong to the Hashkafa that the Rav Zatzal followed. I helped draft that statement. I can't tell you I fully agree with the final version. I'll show you my opinion in a moment in all of these things. And then there's the opinion that it is essential by direct mouth suctioning. And this is a derabbanan, based upon, as Dr. Gesundheit mentioned, through Misora, through Gizeras Rabbanan, however you wish to phrase that derabbanan, that there's an obligation to do so midrabbanan. Because, as the Teferis Yisrael says, we doctors don't always know the sakana aspect, and that maybe there is something there we don't understand, that even though we think we do, we may not understand. And that is the far opinion to the other extreme that says it's somehow a halacha l'moshe b'sina. And there are poskim that say this is a halacha l'moshe b'sina. Yeah, you're not going to find it in the Gemara. But this is a da'araisa halacha l'moshe b'sina. A minority opinion for sure, but is postulated and written in tshuvas by various gedolei Yisrael. To dismiss it out of hand is wrong. To follow it halacha l'maisa, that's not your rab, that's not your psak, you don't have to follow it. But we have to acknowledge it. And therefore, the two questions that we have to ask, is it ma'akev? If you don't do mitzitza, the peh, mamish, not mamish, indirect, what's the halacha? Is the mila kosher? And then number two, is all of this worth fighting about? At what point does it pay sometimes to sit back and say, let's try to work this out behind the scenes, as I mentioned before? So this goes into the question of risk taking in halacha. How much risk are we allowed to take in halacha? And I don't have time to give this. This is normally a separate presentation that I give in an entire hour. But basically, it depends on all of these factors. If something is a mitzvah, you're allowed to take risks that you might not be allowed to take if it's not a mitzvah. If something's for parnasa, the classical tshuva from the Noda of Yehuda, you're allowed to go hunt. So he says, if you're a trapper, if you're a hunter, you're selling pelts, you sell venison, and the only way you can get it is by hunting it, so you're allowed to. It's risky. A person's allowed to take risks. A person's allowed to be a fireman. A person's allowed to be an infectious disease person. A person's allowed to go and do parnasa activities that involve more risk that you wouldn't be allowed to do if it was recreational. No, the Yehuda says it's not a good thing for a Jew to go hunting for recreational activities, but it's perfectly permissible to go and hunt because you're a hunter. So why you're doing it depends greatly. Is it a mitzvah, parnasa, or shus? The level and frequency of the risk. The post can talk about your chassid shalt if you do certain things that the risk is greater than 50%, the famous tashbase. So you're not allowed to do something, even though you're doing a l'shei mitzvah, if the risk is too great. Lower risk. At what point is it so insignificant, halachically risky, that we classify it as dosh bei rabin? So that number, I have asked numerous gedolei Yisrael and have not gotten specific answers. I've gotten various answers. I once asked this to Rav Sternbuch Shlita, one of the great gedolei Yisrael. He told me he felt it was 1 in 100. I asked it to Rav Shechter Shlita. He told me he thought it would be somewhere in the 5 or 10% area. I asked the other gedolei, other different times and places. Nobody wants to be pinned down on something like this. Rav Moshe in the Tshuvas, in the Igros Moshe, I'll show you in a second, gives you a very interesting concept which I'd like to apply here, and I'll show you that in a second. But it also depends on the context and generation. There is Manu Shmad, you're mechuyev to give up your life for even changing the type of shoelace that they're telling you to wear. So it depends when and what you're talking about. If this becomes a circumcision question, so then you might be mechuyev to do things that you wouldn't otherwise be mechuyev to do to preserve circumcision. Dosh Bei Rabin. I gave you some sources in the sheets, and you can look at them yourself. A person, halacha l'maaseh, is told, don't be overly cautious. They ask you, you have a rare blood type, and you can save somebody's life. Do I have to do that? It's risky, it's painful. So it says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to judge you the way you judge yourself. If you're not, I'm not willing to take a risk for anybody else, so then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will say, I'm not willing to take a risk for you, basically. The Midrash Atah Modei Modenoso. The way you judge other people, that's the way you're going to be judged. So, Halacha l'maaseh, Mishnah Berurah, Aruch HaShulchan, Shulchan Aruch HaRav, we'll bring down. Don't be too overly cautious about doing certain things, especially if it's the performance of a mitzvah. However, we have to find what's the right ground. The best example that I could think of was smoking. Rav Moshe said in 1964, the same year that the Surgeon General came out with his psak, and the tshuvas are in the packet, you can look at them yourself, I underlined the highlighted parts. Rav Moshe says in 1964 there was insufficient evidence to say it didn't fall under the rubric of Dosh Bei Rabin. I guarantee you that in 1964 there was more evidence connecting smoking with health risk than there is today for Matzitza Mepet and herpes. I guarantee you that. Rav Moshe reiterated the same Psak Halacha in 1984 when there was far more evidence that smoking is very, very dangerous. And Rav Moshe still said, Dosh Bei Rabin. One could rely upon the principle that it's insignificant enough of a risk that you could assess somebody from doing smoking. So, Laniya Dati, if Rav Moshe would not allow you to assess smoking, again, many would disagree. I'm not here to discuss that either. But Rav Moshe, in the last published tshuva, just about the last year or two of his life, when there was significant medical evidence to suggest the risk and high danger of smoking, which nobody in this room would dispute, Rav Moshe was not willing to say it didn't fall under the rubric of it's an acceptable risk to smoke, and halachically you can't answer a person. Certainly, Laniyaz Dati, one can apply that principle and say if somebody has a reason to do Matzitza B'Peh Mamish, that he would have the halachic right to do so. Same thing with Mila in the Midbar. They didn't do Mila in the Midbar because of the lack of a certain type of a wind. And you can look in these. I'm running out of time, so I won't bore you with the specifics, but I gave you all the source material in your packet over Shabbos to read it. Let's get some very practical, my personal perspective on what happens when people ask me this Shabbos. So it all depends on what your view is on the various halachic spectrum. If halacha l'maaseh, you say matzitza b'peh of any sort is purely, as a simple reading of the Gemara does suggest, albeit the Mefarshim don't necessarily agree with that, as the simple reading says it's purely medicinal, then I would hazard that Matzitza B'Peh Mamish should be prohibited. Because albeit not proven, why would you take a chance? I would be choshesh for that idea. But only if I felt that there was zero halachic imperative to do so. So then if somebody were to ask me their advice, and they say, my Rebbe told me, I hold this opinion, which I don't think anybody really Lamaisa holds today, because even everybody who holds that the Tiferes Yisrael is right, they still do Metzitza B'Peh, not Mamish. But let's say you held this way. I would tell them that Metzitza B'Peh is prohibited if you're going to do it with direct oral general contact. Not because it's proven, but I would be choshesh for it. Why take a chance when there is absolutely no halachic imperative to do so? Number two, indirect suction is allowed. It doesn't hurt. Nobody's ever shown that that's harmful. So if you want to do it and be choshesh for the other sheep, it's fine. But it wouldn't be necessary according to this opinion. However, going down the spectrum, if Metzitza B'Peh is essential but can be performed in any way, take a suction machine. Right, we have very, very powerful suction machines. Take a suction machine. So then, Metzitza B'Peh Mamish, I can't tell you it's osur. I wouldn't recommend it. I would be choshesh for that rare potential concern that it could be transmitted. Not because it's been proven. But why take a chance if there's a halachically acceptable way to do it otherwise? But I would say that you have to do some sort of suctioning because that's what the halacha of this psak says. If you say that some sort of b'peh involvement, direct or indirect, so then I would say again, don't do it b'peh mamish. If you hold, as do most of the RCA poskim, Rav Shechter, Rav Willig Shlita, both of them, as the Rav Zatzal held, as the Rav's father, Rav Moshe held, as quoted by Rav Shechter, Rav Chaim Griske held, and many others held, if you hold that Metzitza b'peh mamish is not essential, so then I wouldn't recommend it. I wouldn't say it's also. I wouldn't recommend it. I would be choshesh for the excellent talk that Rabbi Dr. Gesundheit gave. I would be choshesh for it. Because why not? There's no reason not to be choshesh for it. Because it's a chashash, and I got a perfectly halachically acceptable way. But I would defend to the death somebody's right to disagree with that. And therefore, indirect suffering the tomb is required. That's the psak halacha. And finally, if you hold, like many, as Dr. Danny so eloquently pointed out, in many in the Haredi world, in many poskim, maybe the majority of poskim, hold today that Metzitza B'Peh Mamish is required. So then we, even if we disagree with that opinion, have to go full force and support that halachic approach. And therefore, indirect suction by tomb is not acceptable. Halachically, according to those poskim, I'm not arguing whether they're right or wrong, but according to those poskim, we can't be blind. Those poskim say, you must do Metzitza B'Peh Mamish. So we have to defend their halachic right to do so. Unless they're extenuating circumstances. I want to read you a tshuva from the Shevet HaLevi. I don't think anybody's ever confused the Shevet HaLevi, or was the Shlita of being a modern Orthodox rabbi. I happen to learn and have gotten my smicha from the Dayan Ravon Tzvi Vosner Shlita, the Nechet of the Shevet HaLevi. So I have a personal connection to one of my great rabbeim, to the Shevet HaLevi. I want to read you what the Shevet HaLevi wrote, two places in his tshuvas. I didn't put them in the package. You can get the quotes from me later on. He writes, what about doing Metzitza B'Peh Mamish, which he holds is absolutely required on an adult? You have a Russian, a 45-year-old Russian comes to the United States, never had Bris Milah, and now you want to do Bris Milah on him. Should you do Metzitza B'Peh Mamish on a 45-year-old adult male? What does he say? He says, do the Metzitza ba'ofen acher, yesh tamin unimukim ein tzarech lefarish. There are many good reasons why we wouldn't say to do Metzitza B'Peh Mamish on such a 45-year-old adult male. You got to have a little seichel. You have to know when to apply the din. How to apply the din. Listen to another statement that a gadol b'Yisrael says, looking at the nolad, looking at the future. He says, Mihu v'adai d'b'makom sheyesh chashash sh'ayidei yevatu mitzvah mila legamrei. How many irreligious people that allow a bris mila to be done on their kids because the bubby wants it done, or because this is what Jews did, my father had it done, I'll have it done, my kid will have it done, but they're totally irreligious. How many of them will not have a bris mila because they read in the newspapers, they read in the lay press, in the Jewish lay press, that Metzitza B'Peh, and that they correlate that with bris mila. He says, if this discussion is going to cause people not to do a bris milah, says multiple yos benet snuyim moshkin yedayim. Remove yourself from the controversy. Why are we having public discussions in front of non-religious people outside of the Beis Medrash who are then going to not do bris milah? That's something that we have to think about. If we're preventing a single bris milah because we are so akshonim in doing mitzitza bepeh without a halachic reason for it, or in an appropriate background Beis Medrash discussion, to yotzei shechorim b'hefseidu, we're having more harm than good. Bottom line is, I hold to my rabbein. My rabbein do not mandate mitzitza b'peh mamish. I don't recommend or mandate mitzitza b'peh mamish. My rabbanim demand that we respect the shitos that do allow and do require mitzitza b'peh mamish. I think that there's a theoretical risk. I don't think it's been proven. I'm choshesh for that risk. Somebody was to ask me, I feel halachically my rabbanim have the certainly the soldiers which I can stand upon to say, don't do mitzitza b'peh mamish, do it with a tube, do it with shofaris, do it in a way that is halachically acceptable to them. But I also say it's absolutely essential for every one of us to defend the right of those that have a different halachic viewpoint and to allow mitzitza b'peh mamish and to defend mitzitza b'peh mamish. So the next question isn't coming up, does mitzitza have to be done in suctioning in the operating room, or can only be done when they reach the age of consent, or can only be done in a situation where it's medically indicated, because it's a slippery slope, and Rahmanul Islam, we certainly don't want to reach that point in time. So I thank you all very, very much. Ask your Rav how to paskin this shaila for you, halacha l'maisa, and shalom al Yisrael.
Can ask the speakers and Rabbi Steinberg if you would. We'll have a panel. If you've had some questions, please forward them down. So a couple of points in terms of time and housekeeping. Here's what we're going to do. We're running a little bit behind. Not unexpected, given the fact that. So I have several questions here, which I'm going to read, and some of them are addressed to the individual, so I will start. Dr. Berman, you make the New York Board of Health sound like an evil syndicate. Who is responsible for skewing the findings and data, and what is their motivation? And by the way, I just want to set some background rules and parameters before we even begin this. Thank you for fantastic presentations. It has to be remembered that as we address these questions, they're being addressed not to individuals, but to basically the audience. I would really appreciate it that this becomes not a face-to-face debate. That's not the point. Also, in terms of addressing the questions, you've had an opportunity to do the presentation. I'm inundated with questions. We could probably spend the rest of the day looking at the questions here. Brevity is going to have to be the recipe for this. Please address the question to the audience. Don't lecture in terms of a presentation because we just don't have the time for it. And above all, I'm going to ask everybody in the audience and the speakers themselves to please, I know it's unnecessary, but I understand from the theme of the way it was this morning, it was with the most utmost of respect and covet for each other, and I would ask that be the highlight. So, Dr. Berman.
Yes, I'm sorry if someone took my comments that way. I never said that. I never meant that. And I never thought that. I still don't think that. I think what's behind it is that, as Dr. Gesundheit said, using common sense, or as I said, on a theoretical basis, it's very logical to think that there's a risk. And without the halachic perspective, if you come from, you're not a frum Jew, and you hear about this idea of the mohel putting his mouth on the penis during the circumcision and sucking the blood, just intuitively, but the world, it sounds terrible. So it's very natural for them to look at this in that kind of way. And I think that's what's underlying. I think they're well-intentioned, and I think they feel there's a danger. I think they focus a little bit too much on the danger to the exclusion of other dangers. But underlying, I never meant to suggest there's any evil. I think it's just a skewed way of looking at it because they don't have a perspective of Orthodox Judaism understanding a sacred part of that religion.
Dr. Gesundheit, in a case where there is assurance that the absence of HSV-1, for example, a father to perform the mila on his son, what would your view be on this, the teeth of the pet?
Say it again.
There is an assurance that the individual who's going to do the tithe does not have HSV-1, or the father wants to do the tithe himself. How would you feel about this procedure?
The way I would feel, based on my understanding of the text of the Gemara, I try to explain that very, very clearly. I don't see any remez, no hint, no gematria in the text that mitzitza bepeh is dictated from the Gemara. I know that there are poskim who hold like that. It's not in Shabbat Kuf Lamed Gimel. If there is any other source, please show me. Rav Papa would fire him. I'm convinced from the text. There is a context, and Dr. Rabbi Glatt presented it very nicely. There is a context. Esav sonei Yaakov. There is a tradition. People feel that's the only way it has to be done. There are a lot of minhagim. I would like to explain him the same way you shouldn't ski in a way which is dangerous or potentially dangerous. Don't do it in the name of the halacha. You want to be, I don't want to say another word, you want to be on your own, you want to do chumras, do it on your own head. Don't endanger anybody else. Certainly not b'shem halacha. Therefore I'm very clear to any bris I'm going to, and I have a lot of reports that people do it, what you mentioned, Dr. Berman, we are cousins now, we talk very openly. I saw many, many Brit Milah, and I know the Moralim, who do repeated mitzitza. And they quote the Aruch HaShulchan, and there is a Zohar HaBrit, and there are more ma'od ba'od svarim that you do it as long as there is blood. So I would certainly not recommend to do it to him, because I think it's a mishigas. You can take ketchup, but it's not a mitzvah. You feel ketchup is helpful, bakasha. Do it on your own finger. Don't endanger anybody else. And I think I feel strongly, and I want to say that clearly, for the society in Israel, the context is that chas v'shalom it is a chilul Hashem that the child is admitted. I really want to avoid that, b'shem hadat, b'shem haTorah. I understand what Dr. Rabbi Glatt explained, that there is anti-Semitism. 2 months ago, or 4 weeks ago, in Germany, in Köln, there was a law that it shouldn't be performed because a Muslim was injured. Should we provide them a case that circumcision, which has strong support, circumcision might be dangerous due to a little detail which is not part of the mitzvah, chas v'shalom. But I can understand what you pointed out very clearly to respect the other opinion. I understand the Golos approach that if you agree with A, they will do B. They will agree B. Chtam Sofer was very clear. A is not a mitzvah. Don't think about it. His students were very clear differently. Respecting the Rebbe, they didn't publish it. He would have said that. I'm not bigger than the Chtam Sofer, and I know it will continue, the mitzitzah bepeh. But please, not b'shem halacha.
It's very interesting. Total aside, I don't think we're and by the way, I don't think there's really that much disagreement on all of these things. I want to read you something. The Rebelski Shlita, one of the major poskim today from Torah Das. He writes, this is, I have a handwritten quote from him. He says that the reason today that we have this problem, why is the Tama Namshala Levata La'inyan the Mitzitza B'Peh, why are they so against it? It's because they're not doing Mitzitza B'Peh right. And this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's way of getting us to do it right, because he says, he brings down the Rambam, who says that you have to go and do Mitzitza B'Peh much better than we're doing it. Just putting your lips on for a second probably doesn't, according to this Rambam, doesn't fulfill the obligation to do mitzitza b'peh. So just, it's a total interesting twist on the idea that the Mitzitza B'Peh that everybody's arguing about might not be sufficient anyway. So, just interesting idea.
There are many questions that relate to risk, and I would like to put two of them together and direct them to Rabbi Dr. Steinberg. One of the questioners asks, why take any risk at all? Another one is related to the issue of risk-taking in terms of, as an example that we heard this morning, skiing. And the question is interesting in that, should the father, as both the legal and halakhic proxy of the child, and we heard last night in terms of some of the discussions in the past year with the committee that was created in Israel, so therefore, the legal and halakhic proxy of the child, should they not be allowed to make those decisions on behalf of the child from a risk-taking point of view?
Yeah, so before I answer it, I want to relate to Dr. Gesundheit's comment. It is true that if you read the text in Masechet Shabbos, then there's no mention of Bepeh. It's not mentioned as such. There is a strong recommendation to do Metzitza, and whoever doesn't do it will be fired, but it's not mentioned Bepeh. Now, there's a whole host of poskim, and with this I disagree with you, that feel that Metzitza Bepeh is the requirement. And I don't think that we, just learning Gemara, can disregard such a whole host of poskim. So I don't think that it is correct to say that once we formulated our opinion, all other opinions are totally irrelevant. And I can show you, probably by number, there are more who hold that Metzitza Bepeh is a requirement than those who hold that Metzitza Bepeh is not a requirement. So I think that is one issue. Second issue, there are poskim who hold to the degree that Metzitza Bepeh is important, that if circumcision is performed in a hospital, let's say the child stayed to the eighth day in the hospital, and the hospital doesn't allow as an infectious disease policy to do it, they require to postpone the bris in order to do the Metzitza Bepeh once the child is at home, which is certainly a deraita to do it on the eighth day. And yet they feel so strongly that it has to be done. So I don't think that presenting it as a way that there's only one opinion and the rest is non-halachic opinion, I think that is going a little bit too far. It is true that there is an opinion that you don't need it. Now, Rabbi Glatt, I think, was very correct by saying don't bring it out into the public, certainly not amongst the goyim, and don't show that we are fighting amongst ourselves in such a bitter way. We don't have this privilege in Israel. Israel is a state, and we need to have regulations as a state. And therefore, there is an official body in Israel, which is an interministerial committee composed of the chief rabbinate and the Ministry of Health. And I am a member in this body. And this committee has the duty to license mo'alim. They have to go through tests, and they have to be tested, and they have to be supervised. Not everyone who wants to become a mo'al is a mo'al like in the rest of the world. B, if there are complaints against Mo'ali who did something wrong, it comes to our committee. And C, we formulate policies. Now, the poskim of this committee were Arav Eliashiv and Arav Vozner. I think certainly people that, whether you agree with everything they say or not, you can't disregard them. I mean, that is for sure. And both, I presented to them when your article came out in 2002 or 3, and I presented the article and the facts and the way I understood it, and we won't go into the debate again, and both paskin that Metzitza Bepeh should continue. And that is the formal policy of the committee, of the interministerial committee. Just a week ago, before I left to come to this conference, the Israeli Association of Pediatrics, the Pediatric Association of Israel, issued a prohibition against Metzitza Bepeh and went to the Ministry of Health, requiring that the Ministry of Health will disallow it, will rule that you can't do it. I met with the director general of the ministry, and we discussed the matter. He's not a firm person, although the minister is, obviously, that's Litzman, who is certainly he won't allow it. But even before getting to him, he issued a ruling that everyone can go according to what they feel is right. It's a religious way. There is no proof that there is a danger, and therefore everyone can continue their own way. But there has to be some form of consent, not a written consent. So we issued, you'll see it in the handout, a position paper of this interministerial committee, what our view is in principle in both ways. But I think what we didn't hear in the whole discussion is that if already we do metzitza bepeh, how to do it best to minimize the risk. And I think that is an important issue that didn't come up, and I suggest you read some of the suggestions that we recommended, one of which was, and I think you'll be the first to hear the explanation, is that in appropriate circumstances, informed consent should be obtained. Now, what is appropriate circumstances? So our idea is that if you come to Mea Shearim or to Zichron Meir and you want an informed consent for not metzitza bepeh, yes metzitza bepeh, you'll be thrown out of the house. I mean, who there has ever heard that you do a bris without metzitza bepeh? So there's no need to get an informed. It doesn't make sense. On the other side, if you come to Tzfon Tel Aviv or to Kfar Shmayahu and you talk about metzitza bepeh, you'll be thrown out for this reason. So there, do metzitza b'shofet. It's fine. There are poskim who allow it, and why not do it? So in appropriate circumstances, those who you are not sure if they want or don't want, and as I wrote to Dr. Berman and we looked into it, there is a growing number of Orthodox Jews who require metzitza bepeh, not necessarily Haredi. So if you don't know what they feel and how they want, ask them and tell them what the situation is. That is our recommendation. Now I'm coming to the question. I just wanted to make sure that it's not black and white, and I think that is important to understand. Now, as Rabbi Blatt very eloquently summarized his position, that is actually the position of the Interministerial Committee, that we accept halachically both ways are legitimate, and therefore, if you hold that metzitza bepeh is not part of the metzitza, we don't need any studies, just by what you call common sense. I mean, certainly there can be some infection, not necessarily herpes, can be bacterial infection as well. I mean, the mouth isn't clean, and why should you do it? So don't do it, that's clear. On the other hand, if you hold that it's part of the mitzvah, I don't understand why this is attacked more than, for instance, doing priya with a nail. I mean, show me one surgeon in an operating room that is separating tissues with his bare nail. And that would be okay. Why not ban this? This is not a doraita to do it by a fingernail. So that was never attacked. Or go to the circumcision itself. There are so many complications, hemorrhages, and severance of part of the penis. There are so many problems there. Why do it? So you understand that you're allowed to take the risk, as Rabbi Blatt showed, when there is a mitzvah that is part of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, to take this type of risk. And therefore, if metzitza bepeh is part of the mitzvah, then even if there is a remote risk, you should take it. That's so remote that you should take it. And finally, why attack the parents' decision to make metzitza bepeh with the remote risk of having herpes and allow them to pierce the ears for nothing, and so many infections happen there? Or take the child in a car in Israel for a trip. That is a greater risk, 10 times more than metzitza bepeh. Why don't you interfere with parental decisions on how to raise their children? And the same holds true for the German ruling. By the way, the German ruling was not on Jews. They were for Muslims. I don't know if people know him. So it is not overtly anti-Semitic. I mean, it's anti-Semitic in a sense that they are also Semites, but not anti-Semitic towards Jews. But what was their argument? Very similar to what we hear here. It is not the parental allowance to endanger the child when the child cannot get an informed consent. So if you take away from the parent their rights to raise their children the way they want, even if it entails risk, then take away the whole meal. Why only take away the mitzvah of a pet? So I think the parental decision-making towards their children sometimes entails risks and dangers, and if they are reasonable and if they have a reason, they should be allowed, as long as it is not 50% chance of risk or it's done out of bad neglect or whatever, if you can prove it. But if it's done from a religious raising, I don't see why this became the major issue today.
There are more questions, just in terms of timing. We'll break for a few minutes. On the schedule, there's a 20-minute break for nutrition, and the food is located in the where we ate this morning. We're going to probably trim a little bit from each of the speakers by 5 minutes, and try to regain about 15 minutes from there. I'm going to take just one or two more questions here, and then I think we'll break the session here and give our people an opportunity to break for a couple of minutes. But if people want to still have some further discussions, I'm sure they will. We'll go there. I think it's a fascinating question, I'll just read it as is. If tomorrow circumcision were found to be ruled to be dangerous, how would we respond, Rabbi Glatz?
Circumcision in general.
So
this question was already found and asked and answered in the Midbar. And that's one of those sources that I gave you, where halacha lemaisa, the people were not mal in the Midbar because they felt that it would be a sakonis nefashis. And the Gemara clearly paskins for an individual, if this is true, this is a big if here, so I'm assuming that the answer is that there truly is a risk that is found. So halacha lemaisa, you're not allowed. It's usur to do bris mila on somebody with this pikuach nefashos. So it's a very important question, but it's a very, very well known and asked and answered question. Baruch Hashem, I'm very confident, I'm not a Navi, I'm not a Ben Navi, but I will predict that they will never find such a thing ever happening. Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu said that we're supposed to have a bris mila on day 8, there is no way possible that we'll ever come out and find that it is dangerous to do a bris mila, because by definition, HaKadosh Baruch Hu would not give us a mitzvah to do that is more dangerous than HaKadosh Baruch Hu has allowed us to do. Bris mila is somewhat dangerous, but that risk is considered acceptable, but it's not a significant enough risk that it will ever become medically proven that bris mila is dangerous, that bris mila in general will ever be abolished.
Dr. Berman, aseptic techniques of Moses varies greatly. Your comments.
I agree with that, but again, that same discussion about aseptic technique would be for a bris mila, as would be mitzitz of a pet. So if you want to entertain that discussion should be focused on bris mila in general and not about mitzitz of a pet. And my area is about mitzitz of a pet, and it's true, but that's all. It's another discussion about what to do about circumcision in general.
So the question is really asking, in other words, should there be using gloves for and other sterile techniques, the instruments that are sometimes pass over a little bit of alcohol for 12 seconds or less, and other items of that nature. I mean, should that be something that that we should be questioning? Should we be policing ourselves?
I would say absolutely. I think there's a chiyuv d'oraisa on every moel to use sterile technique as much as possible without putting in the specifics. There's a mitzvah to protect ourselves. You're not allowed to do a bris mila if you don't know how to do a bris mila. You're not allowed to do a bris mila if you don't do a bris mila properly. A person needs to follow sterile technique. Now, whether that means wearing gloves or not, one could make an argument that a bris mila might be able to be done more efficiently without gloves. I've had surgeons tell me that a double glove technique makes their hands clumsy, and we recommend using double gloves. Without getting into the details of the specifics, I think each moral needs to optimize his performance of the bris milah to be done in the way that will make as low, if not zero, any potential theoretical, practical risks that occur. Moral needs to be trained properly. Can't see one, do one, teach one. You really need to know what you're doing if you're doing a bris milah. You should rigorously adhere to acceptable medical practices, which, by the way, are in the Gemara. There's one comment I wanted to make before. The Gemara talks about every single route of infection control and infection transmission. The Gemara in Ketubas and Daf Ayin Zayin Amud Beis or Ayin Ches. The Gemara discusses all the known, recommended, or possible routes of transmission of disease well before Semmelweis, well before Lister, well before any of them. Just wish I knew that Gemara before I had studied medicine, because then I could have had my name up there with all those greats in science.
I just want to add one more comment. The logical extension of that is that it should be done only in an operating room. So we do say that we're not going to go to the full infection control measures that we do for any operation. So as the question is exactly where we go, that's a discussion that we can have. And as Dr. Rabbi Aaron said, that you have to maximize what the mole can do best, but we clearly don't go to the ultimate to follow infection control.
Just a comment on the gloves issue. I don't see why gloves are not used. There was a suggestion that it's a chitza, but there's no real halachic issue that there is an issue of chitza to do mila. There's nothing mentioned in it, so why not? The other point was that you need the fingernail to do the priya, so you can make a little hole, and some, I know Mohalim who can do it very tight so that the fingernail can still do the priya under the cover of the glove. And yet, at least in Israel, no Moel is using gloves, and I don't know why not. I mean, if this is something that we understood today that we didn't know before, and it doesn't interfere in any way with a halachic issue, why not do it? So here is something that an article by Dr. Gesundheit
says. Should this be the next fertile, for ourselves to be, comment and then brief?
I would like to ask a question, if that's okay.
Okay.
I would like to ask about Professor Steinberg. And to everybody, it is clear from the text of the Gemara that it is to prevent sakana, that the mitzitza has no implication on pe. As Professor Steinberg explained, Harbe Poskim said we should do pe, over the century it was done like that. You even postpone the midoraita on the eighth day in order to have mitzitza pe outside the office. I ask you a question, a simple question like, what's the concept? What's the idea that people fight for mitzitza? For a little detail in mitzitza bepeh, there is so much to be done on basic midoraita stuff, on chinuch, on shabbat, on many things. Why do we focus to take a gemara, change the meaning of the gemara, totally change it, and we fight, and it's chilul Hashem? I had also a concern when I wrote the second paper explaining the background. I explained it only in Hebrew, harafuah. But I don't understand, why do we fight for things which are really not in the text? Rav Papa said, fire a mohel who is not careful. So it should be exactly the opposite. What happened to us? Is it all?
Papa has to be answered in a Reader's Digest version.
Yeah, so two answers to it. One, in Zohar it says specifically that you have to do with pay. And when there is no contradiction in the Nigle to the Nistar, we behave like the Nistar. So first of all, there is a clear source, that is for sure. Secondly, I think you alluded to it, Mayitz and Motzetz have a meaning, and Motzetz is usually Bepe, so he doesn't need to say Bepe. That is the understanding of the Gemara. Motzetzim, the way to do it is Bepe. There's no other way. I mean, certainly in the days of the Gemara there was no tube to do it, so they certainly did it by faith. So the text itself, I didn't want to go into it, but the text itself can be interpreted directly by faith and can stay by faith, and certainly, according to the Nistar, it is a must. Now, the second part, why do we fight for it? Why don't you ask about the mitzitza itself? Do you understand why we need mitzitza? Show me one surgical procedure today that in order for the surgery to conclude, you have to do some kind of sacking, whether bepe or not bepe. it doesn't make any sense. Why should we do metzitza altogether? So if the reading of the Gemara is that it is only done for sakona, and today we know that there is no meaning to it from the sakona point of view, there are so many things that we have changed because we understand it differently, including in Mila. One of the sources in Mishnah is that you have to wash the baby in hot water on the third day, and you're being given the Chal Shabbos for it. Today we don't do it. Why? Because we understand that it has no meaning. So if your reading is correct, that it's all related to Sona, we have to abandon Metzitza altogether. I didn't find any reasonable reason why there is a Sona by doing Metzitza. There are all kinds of suggestions. I think they are far-fetched and not reasonable. So we are doing it because this is how the mitzvah is done. And if there is no proof to do it differently, there's no reason to change it. That's the position.
Sadly, I'm going to have to bring this to a close.